Hey, everybody, welcome back to the show and welcome first timers. So before we get to my guest, my one-man show, Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio, which has been on Broadway, is moving venues. Starting September 12th, we're going to be at the Actors Temple Theater on West 47th Street in New York City, right there in the heart of Times Square, right where all the action is. Show's been getting great reviews, great response. It's a show where the audience gets to tell stories from their lives. They've been funny, they've been bizarre, they've been interesting. Like the guy who has been married 30 years and he has two 30-year-old kids. And I said, oh, your kids are twins? He goes, no. I go, well, how do you have two 30-year-old kids and they're not twins? He goes, well, I was 17. I met a woman at church and got her pregnant. And then 9 months later, I met my wife there, points to his wife in the audience. And 9 months later, met her and got her pregnant. So, yeah. Guy met two different women, and within 9 months of each other at the age of 17, got him pregnant. They're both from his church. That's one hell of a church, and I'm a member now. Anyway, but we're getting amazing stories. It's really cool. If you're in town starting September 12th and onward, please come and check out a show. You're going to be able to get tickets at telecharge.com. They'll be going on sale shortly. You can check my website and keep an eye on my website for more information, but mark it in your calendar. And we'll be having some really fun shows. Now, football season is here. And you know what that means. My posters go back up of dreamy Tom Brady. And, well, I shouldn't say back up. Additional posters go up. I'm up to number 77 and 78 in my man cave. I don't really have a man cave. I just have a small room with no windows. And yes, I'm a Patriots fan. I grew up in Rhode Island, so deal with it. And so the Tom Brady dreamy posters, which I put lipstick on occasionally. I can't really get into more detail than that. And then there's my Gronk skull mug made out of paper mache athletic socks of Gronk, actual socks he used in practice. I'm on two stalker lists. That's all I'm saying, according to the Patriots. But anyway, I want to talk to you about BetDSI. They're a sponsor of the show. I hope you'll consider this and listen to this because they support this show, which allows me to bring you this show. So I hope you'll support them. You want to double your money guaranteed? Well, my friends at BetDSI are making that possible. This football season, when you register with the promo code PAUL100. Let me explain. NFL, NCAA football seasons are here. Take your pigskin knowledge to the bank at BetDSI.com. Now, to help you get started with some extra bang for your buck, this is really great. BetDSI is offering you to double your money on your first deposit. So you deposit to start winning. You get up to $2,500 free. That's double your money right from the get-go when you use the promo code PAUL100. Look, when it comes to football, BetDSI has odds on everything you'd ever want or imagine, whether it's the NFL, NCAA, MLB, NBA, esports, when I'll probably get arrested for stalking. Anything, all right? If it's happening, BetDSI will put a line on it. BetDSI has been online for 20 years. Come on, that's a long time. Built an impeccable reputation for great service, fast payment, combined with an excellent mobile interface where you can play, win, and get paid anytime, anywhere, all right? You don't have to do it on a street corner, the way I get paid when I do my stand-up at night in a paper bag. Anyway, that's another story. You know you're ready to win. Join BetDSI.com today using promo code PAUL100. That's PAUL100. You're already won by doubling your bankroll straight away. That's promo code PAUL100 to get in on the action and get paid. Don't stand on the sidelines this season. Be in it to win it and enjoy the games that much more when you play at BetDSI. All right. Enjoy my guest this week, everybody. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show and welcome to first-time listeners. Very, very interesting and funny and iconic guest on the show with me right now. His name is Billy West, voiceover artist, comedian. You might know him as the voice of Philip J. Fry, Zoidberg, Zap Brannigan on Futurama, Ren of Ren and Stimpy, which was one of my favorite shows ever. He's the red plain milk chocolate M&M. He's Buzz the Honey Nut Bee. Just incredible body of work. And it's Billy West. Hey, Billy, how's it going?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. It's
Hey, I'm curious because I got a really good friend who's a stand-up. His name is Brian McFadden. He's done a lot of voiceover work over the years, and his father was a voice of Count Chocula for years. And do you know Brian at all? And you guys kind of run into each other?
I ran into him probably a couple of times when I used to live in New York, but that was a long time ago. But I was very aware of his dad. His dad did a lot of cartoon work in the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah. He was kind of iconic. I'm curious, you're the voice, of the three characters in the new Netflix animated series, Disenchantment, which is out from Matt Groening. You're, Sorcerio, the Jester, Pops the Elf. It seems like a really cool, interesting show. Give people a little bit of a sense of sort of what the backstory is of it and the concept of it is.
It's kind of like Middle Earth, Middle Ages sort of fantasy, where there's Greenland is where all these people live and where all the action takes place, and it centers around three central characters. One of them is an alcoholic princess. played by Abby Jacobson, and then there's a demon who is in the form of a cat, like a black cat, and he's got this big eye, you know, and everything. But his name is Lucy, but he's I'm sure it's short for Lucifer, and it's played by Eric Andre. Then there's this character Elfo, who was probably like Philip J. Fry, you know, he's like unassuming and sweet and everything, but he just he doesn't know a whole lot. His heart's in the right place, played by Nat Faxon. And these three stalwarts, erstwhile intrepid, however you want to label them, you know, just get through life with this domineering father, which is the king Zog, played by John DiMaggio. She's kind of fearless, you know, and I'm not sure if it's the alcohol or whatever, but she's really cool.
The princess.
Beanie.
Yeah.
Yeah. They call her, Bean for short. And, I play some incidental characters, semi-regular characters. One is the character you mentioned, Sorcerio. He's the court, sorcerer.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, well, a couple of drops of elf blood. What difference would it make? You know, he's kind of sinister. And,
right.
Yeah, and then there's Pops, who's Elfo's father. It's like, my boy Elfo, I'm going to tell you about your mother. She's a real Lulu. You know.
And then there's the jester, yeah.
Who's always on the knife's edge of getting, like, thrown out or murdered because his jokes suck. It's like, you know, he sounds like Sergeant Bilko. He's kind of like, you know, well, the king thought he had everything, but he got busted. Oh, no. You know, and then the trap door opens up under him.
Now, I'm a kind of a process geek, and this world of what you guys do and how you do it is like really fascinating to me. I had Frank Oz on the podcast, and he talked about the process of, it was great. I mean, I usually don't promote my own podcast, but I listen to it if you, given you guys are in the same world, in a lot of ways. But he said, you know, people who do, you know, established voiceover characters like yourself or what we do with the Muppets, he said, you know, we're more than just voices. There's thought that goes into the attitude and the persona and the character, you know, like for example, Miss Piggy, which he created, is insecure because he imbued that character with some of his own insecurities that he's had his whole life. And is that the same case with you? And like, what is your process? So like, when Matt comes up with this concept of a show and has the Jester and Pops the Elf, do you come in with a blank slate and say, this is how I see it, Matt? Or does he give you an idea of what he wants it to be?
He gives you an idea, of course, because he had a vision.
Yeah.
And he's worked with us for so long that he knows what we're capable of. And I think he trusted our choices on a lot of things, you know, but they would tweak and adjust stuff. If I came up with something, they say, can you make it a little more this or a little more that?
Right.
You know, and I'm open to direction because I really like a well-directed situation.
Mm. And
so, they show you pictures of the characters and you would say, what on earth am I going to do with this? You want it to last for all time and you want it to be a classic, hopefully. And, you know, I still have tons of ideas for different characters, but I don't want to, like, you know, you got to be willing to throw away your best shot that you came up with because they might say they want something entirely different. And then you got to scramble a little bit and, you know, try a little harder to bring that much more to the table.
Did you find, so like you just mentioned Phil Silvers, Sergeant Bilko, which was done by the great comedian Phil Silvers, and who just so funny and everything he does, A Mad, 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 Mad World and everything. So why?
Oh, God, yeah.
No, isn't that that's such a great movie. I watched that with my kid recently. He was just on the floor. Like, it's so, it holds up. It's so good. When Jonathan Winters just basically destroys the gas station, he's beating the shit out of everybody. It's so funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I actually got to meet and work with my two idols when I was a little boy. I used to watch, my mom let me stay up with her to watch this show called Your Show of Shows, and it was Sid Caesar.
Right.
And he was a dialectician. He made up his own languages for the characters that he created. And, you know, it would sound like German, but it was gibberish, mm-hmm. French, mm-hmm. Spanish, whatever he wanted to do. And that guy blew me away when I was like, God, I don't know. I had to be about 6 or 7.
Mm.
And I wound up not only meeting him and Jonathan Winters, who was my other comedic hero.
Wow.
Got to work with both of them.
Really? What did you guys work on?
It was a mockumentary about Comic-Con. It was called, Comic Book the Movie. And it had Mark Hamill in it. And I did a scene with my two idols, and I never got over that.
Oh, my God. That's
And they treated me like, you know what they treated me like? You know, I was so nerved out and everything, and they were acting like, you know, hey, we were saving a seat for you, you know?
Oh, that's incredible. That's really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, when something like that happens, it's like, what on earth? You know, it's like beyond your wildest aspirations, really.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, because, you know, I've had the opportunity to meet some really big people and have some, like, nice names on my podcast. And, you know, when you go through this business as talent, you know, comedian, voiceover artist, you know, you put up with a lot of crap. And some days you go, like, why am I putting myself through this? And then you realize, like, if I had a regular 9-to-5 job, I wouldn't be sitting right now acting with Jonathan Winters and Sid Caesar, right? So it's like God gives you that because I think a little bit, this is the way I look at it, because of everything you go through in this business, which can be really tough at times, you know?
Well, you know what? Once I got into the business, things got a little easier because I was always shot out of a can and I was always ready to go.
Mm.
And the hardest time was growing up. You know, it's like my own, I had friends that would be just like sitting there looking at me like, yeah. And then what else happened? You know, when I would work out something really cool at home and I couldn't wait to show them and they'd stand there looking at me, you know.
And
I used to go home and I go, how friggin' good do you have to be to impress these days? So I was pouring on and nothing, no readout. And somebody suggested to me many, many years later, you know, did it ever occur to you that these guys are watching you and you were a constant and painful reminder of what none of them would ever be able to do in their life.
Oh, wow.
I'd hate me too.
Were you doing voices, like, kind of going in with, so were you doing them that early on and you literally would work on them and hone it and thought you had it and they'd just be like, well, what? I don't know. What?
I don't know. It would be like, it was like a shock to their system. I mean, I was a freak, you know. I mean, I just came out of the gate, threading out noises and voices, and I lived in my own little world. No one else was invited, you know, because I was protecting myself. I had a very, very kind of harsh, rough childhood. And I didn't want to spend much time at home, so I sat in the movie theaters or I just sat in the middle of the woods, you know, just acted out characters and stuff.
What was it about being at home that was tough?
Well, my dad was a psycho and a drunk and abuser and crazy. So I was the whipping boy. I got my head punched in every morning before I went to school.
So I
had to battle through a lot of scar tissue, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, you know, you can always point to something in somebody's childhood that explains and informs what they're doing. You know, Bob Costas was on and he talks about, he would lie in bed at night in St. Louis as a kid and with the blanket over his head, listening to transistor radio, listening to Cardinals games. And he said he found himself more enthralled with Jack Buck, the announcer, calling the game than he did the game. I mean, he loves baseball. And he said it was then that I kind of realized that this could be, he said, I was fascinated how just through voice that this guy was able to put me in the place in the moment, and I could see it. He was painting this picture for me and how artistic it was. And so, and that's obvious. Yeah. Yeah. And for you, it's got to be really cool because you're not just doing a voice, but you're either creating these characters or informing them. I mean, you did Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd. Was that like intimidating to take? Those are iconic. Mel Blanc. Like, what was that like to sort of approach
It was two different people.
Mm-hmm.
Mel Blanc and, Bugs Bunny were two different people.
Mm-hmm.
Mel Blanc was Bugs Bunny and Arthur Q. Bryan was Elmer Fudd.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, when I was younger and I even had a career in radio, but I was not convinced that I could ever make any money. So I didn't get into it for that. And I didn't get into it to be famous, certainly. But I had this dying, I was bursting to contribute or bring something to the table. That was my main impetus. And so I grew up listening to those characters, but, you know, people would want you to hold up the tradition or carry on, you know, the voices when the people weren't around anymore. And so I auditioned for stuff and it was like,
yeah, and I got to work with Michael Jordan too, Doc. The closest thing to a religious figure that we have.
You know, and,
very, very quiet. Hunting. Yeah. Whap.
And so you put a little bit of your own spin on it, but you're true to the character and what they did, right?
Yes, but I really tried to be faithful as I could to any of the characters I wound up doing that were classic characters. But the main thing I wanted to do was dreaming about the day when somebody would show me pictures of characters and say, what would you do? So it was like that. It was like that with Futurama. You know, it was like Phil J. Fry was, it sounded like when I was 25 years old, I was all whiny and nasally and complaining. And I played in a band and I was like, oh man, I broke a string. Now what am I supposed to do? You know, the amp's going to blow up. I just know it. We're screwed. You know, everything was like that.
Right.
I just remember it. And
but now you did, you came, you decided that take on him just from the photograph. And what was the animation that, what is it about that that hit you that you felt that was the direction to go in?
Well, he said that everybody was directing me. They said he's 25-year-old pizza delivery boy. And I said, I got to have something. I want to root these characters, even though they're whacked out. I want to root them in some kind of reality so that somebody who's watching them could actually know that person or know somebody like them. I didn't want it to be cloying, annoying, high-pitched, genderless voices, you know, because no one can relate to that, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They had to take their moment and they had to be, you know, you need an autograph? Why not Zoidberg? Why not? You know?
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing where you actually could know somebody like that. The professor was a combination of doddering wizards and magicians and, you know, just like, good news, everyone. It's bad news.
But But I see, this is what's fascinating. This is where the art is sort of like, you look at that, and just from looking at it, I couldn't do it, but that you go, I have a sense of what this, it makes sense to me that you want to root them in reality, because I think they're obviously more relatable, and then that the characters will have longevity. But
yes,
that you have that ability to look at it and then make, there's so many, it's infinite, the number of places you could go with a particular voice for a particular character. And in those cases of Philip J. Fry, Zoidberg, you know, Professor Zapp, did Matt pretty much say, yeah, okay, I think you, each time, I think you pretty much got it? Or was there one where he was like, nah, I really want you to do it this way? Or has that happened in certain cases where, I know you referenced it earlier, but where you kind of had to like sort of back off your own interpretation? Did anything happen like that with Futurama or any other characters that you've done?
Well, I remember auditioning for those guys, and you know, I didn't know that he knew who I was, but I sure knew who he was. And the thing was, is they had me read these different characters, and it was like from my gut. You know, I took a good look at them and just formulated something. Zoidberg had all that cool meat hanging off his face, so I figured he'd be like a marble mouth. And I thought of a couple of guys in showbiz periphery. Over the years, one guy was named George Jessel, and he was a Toastmaster, you know.
I'm George Jessel.
Leaving, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
You know the definition of a smart ass? The fellow that can sit in an ice cream cone and tell you what flavor it is. You know, and then there was Lou Jacoby from Yiddish Theater, and he was in the movie Arthur, and he's that guy that leaned in and went, what's it like to have all that money? You know, so
he sold him the roses, right? Didn't he sell him the roses? Wasn't he the guy in the rose, the flower shop?
Yeah. And but he was kind of a marble mouth, and since Zoidberg had all this cool meat hanging off his face, I figured his speech would be a little impaired, you know.
Yeah.
So that's, I super collided those two guys. What I got was what I got. Zap Brannigan was based on, I was in radio for, God, I don't know, 10 years or 11 years, maybe 12, I don't know.
Yeah, the Howard Stern Show. Yeah, incredible.
Well, yeah, I started in Boston, and then I moved to New York and worked with Howard for a few years. And up until guys like Howard and the guy I worked for in Boston, Charles Blackwoodero, there were a lot of FM jocks that were, you know, they were just in love with the sound of their voice. You know, they had this big, dumb voice, and you know, they would deliberate and ruminate, and that's the mark of somebody who has nothing to say.
Right, right.
You know, well, it's 30 minutes past the big hour of 8 o'clock, yeah? You know.
So they're overcompensating in a way for, you know, they're going to make up for it, yeah.
Yeah, because they don't have anything to say.
Yeah.
You know, I just got a big kick out of that, and I could do it. I could easily do any of that stuff, or newsman, or, you know, any kind of announcer from the 30s on. But it was something about those guys that killed me, and I thought they'd be perfect for Zap Brannigan. They wanted to get Phil Hartman, and I knew Phil before he died. And I worked with him, and he was such a great guy. But we talked about our love of big, dumb announcers from the old days. You know, they love everything, nothing in the world besides the sound of their own voice.
Right.
You know, their balls in a wheelbarrow, and yeah. You know, it's like, oh, shut up. Who talks like
this? Exactly.
But I wanted to make fun of it, and I did it with Zap Brannigan.
Yeah.
And inform the men, I made it with a woman. Nah.
Well, Phil would pull that announcer voice out a lot on SNL. You could tell that was something he really loved to do. And was that Zap Brannigan was created for Phil, but then he died. And that was that sort of a little intimidating to kind of go in and take over that was something that was done for Phil, or
it wasn't part of the original audition because, you know, I think they had that covered. And then we all got the news about Phil, and it was a blow to everybody because he was doing animation and everybody knew him, and and he was so good and everything. But I remember we did an M&M's commercial once together, and he was just very generous of spirit. You know, he knew me from the Stern Show, and I said, you know, I'm trying to get acclimated out, you know, living out in California. He called me at home, as a matter of fact, when I still lived in New York and I was on the Stern Show. Bill Hartman called me.
Wow.
And he said, you know, you should get out of there. You ought to come to California. That's all where the work is for you. Mm-hmm. And I said, geez, you know, well, I kind of know who you are, too.
Wait. Hang on a sec. You didn't know him at all? He just called you out of the blue? Or did you know him a little bit?
Yeah, somebody on the set of news radio had my phone number.
Wow.
He was probably listening to the Stern Show, and some guy said, I know him. I got his number. And he said, oh, please, can I have it? And he called.
That's incredible. That's a huge compliment to your talent that somebody at that level would take the time to call you when they don't know you. That's incredible.
But it was just so out of nowhere. And we chatted about the same stuff that we're talking about now, like those big dumb announcers. You know, you love these guys from the old days who, had that affectation. And he was big on that because he was obviously a fan of old radio like I was.
Right.
And even near old radio, like the 60s, 70s.
Right.
You know, it was always like generic baseball announcers, you know, and looking for that Guidry fastball. Looking for that Ron Guidry fastball.
Yeah, you wonder if they talk like that while they're making love, you know?
Yeah, I know.
It's like... I'm putting it in now. Here it comes.
Chucky darn, there's no lead in my pencil. We're going to run that by again. First, a word from Schaefer. Have a Schaefer beer and be Schaefer people too. Okay, howdy, I'm back.
Oh, God. I think, what do you think of Hank Azaria's Brockmire in that show and what he's done with that? It seems a really interesting character with a lot of dimension to it, you know?
Oh, yeah. So talented, he's wildly talented, and he's got a very versatile voice, and he also has a really incredible grasp of performing a character and everything. I always admired him.
Is there any formal training for you? I know this started as a passion for you as a kid, and what? I mean, do you have to take care of your voice? Are you conscious of that because it's your instrument?
I never wanted to know what was going on in there.
Yeah.
Magical thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like a bumblebee, big fat bumblebee. Well, I always heard that it was aerodynamically impossible for that to fly.
Right.
But the thing is, it doesn't know it.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So I was like, people would say, you can't do that, and that's not right, and this is wrong, and blah, blah, blah. And I never listened to anybody. I just went with my gut.
When you say that, you mean, so you're this kid, tough home, you're trying to escape, you're using this world as a way to escape. Is there somebody, when you're a little older, maybe a teenager, is there somebody that starts to embrace this with you? Did your mom support it? Did you have a teacher or somebody?
No, you know what it was back in those days? No one even understood where you were going.
And you lived in Michigan. You grew up in Michigan, right? It's not like you grew up in Hollywood. Yeah. Right?
Yeah, Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah.
And, everybody was like, you know, my aunt, I talked to my aunt one day, not too long ago, and she said, you were a weird kid. But the thing is all weird kids of their little hometowns, wherever the hell they live, they all wind up in New York and Hollywood, which is a mecca for weird kids.
Right, right. But also those two cities, because of this industry, provides them the outlet to be weird, you know, rather than sort of suppress that and say, yeah, Billy, just go get a job as an engineer. It's like you found a way to put yourself in an environment that actually rewarded you creatively, emotionally, financially for something that was part of you and your DNA.
But when I think about it, it was the hard way because there was no schools, there were no teachers, there were no signposts to tell you this way to show business, to do voices for cartoons.
Right. It
just didn't exist. So whenever you try to say it to anybody, including my mom when I was growing up, it was like trying to explain a desert to a polar bear.
Right.
You know, just, no one knew what to make of what you were saying. And, that's nice, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I understand that. I grew up in Rhode Island, middle class. My father put floors in for a living. My parents have a little furniture store. And when I had another career, I was a lawyer, a banker in, on Wall Street, and I left to be to stand up and write. And my nobody really like, they were like, what? What do you want? You got a law degree. What do you, what, why would you, like, they just, and then I was mad that they didn't understand it. And then I was like, then I stopped being mad about it because I was like, there's no reason that they should understand it. My father, my mother, high school educated, their parents were born in Italy. Like, how, why would I expect them to get their head around? Because it is a kind of a crazy thing to want to do, but it's also, yeah, you know, so I respect that they didn't get it, but was it getting into radio that opened this door to voices? Like, what is there something you can point to that was sort of like the turning point for you where you were now down this road that you knew you could be on?
Well, the pivotal point was, happened real early on. When I lived in Detroit, I was probably about 9, and we had a guitar in the basement, and it was like stuffed into a closet, like a bin. And I fished it out and I began plunking on it. This was 1961. So my mom took me and my two brothers up and left to move to Boston where she had relatives. And then in the winter, Christmas of 1963, my mom got me a guitar. And I started playing it, and I didn't even know how to tune it, but I was playing songs because I made up my own tuning. And, you know, and I started belting out songs, and I realized that when I did these things, I had power coming out of me. You know, I didn't realize what kind of an instrument that I had.
Right.
So I went out and I became a guitar player, and, you know, and I had a career. I did do a lot of stuff. I mean, I wound up playing with Brian Wilson, my musical idol.
Yeah, I read that. How did that come about?
Friend of mine from Boston, Andy Paley, wound up to produce Brian Wilson's first solo record. And he told Brian about me, and Brian said, yeah, sure. So I got together with him, and I knew all his songs. I knew all the parts. You know, seriously, I knew every note in those catalogs.
Wow.
And so we got up and played. We played at Lincoln Center. We played on David Letterman. You know, so I was the guitarist in Brian Wilson's band. Like 4 or 5 gigs.
Unbelievable. And
one of them was singing and playing with his daughter, Wendy, who joined us on stage. I played with Don Was. Yeah, and Andy Paley. My friend who was playing bass, and he also produced Brian's record. But that was an eye opener. But this is when I started doing voices, like on stage. You know, if I broke a string or I needed to BS around, you know, I would just start doing voices and impressions. People liked that better than the cover tunes we were doing. You know, so I realized it was a stir in the southern states. So I kind of got into radio by accident. A friend of mine was installing burglar alarms at this disc jockey's house. His name was Charles Lacordaire, and he was on FM radio in Boston. You probably heard him.
Yeah, I grew up in Rhode Island, so I you know, BCN, I know, WAAF, all those stations,
You had to have heard of him unless you were taken out by the Warm Socket Hit Squad.
No, I heard of him, definitely. I know the name, yeah.
Yeah, I figured. But anyway, I cut my teeth on radio on that show. I mean, I just got tossed into the middle of things.
Well, wait. Your friend's installing alarms in his house. How does it go from that to you getting a job?
He leaves a cassette tape of me with this guy, and the guy wound up calling, asked me if I wanted to come in. It wasn't a job. It was just, you want to come in and screw around. And I said, yeah, sure.
Wow. Seems to be a pattern in your life that your talent draws people to call you, like Phil Hartman, this guy. Like, that's pretty impressive at a young age, you know?
It was, you know, luck in a way. It was a lot of hard work. I mean, I was always up and swinging. You know, when I was playing music, alcohol and drugs really kind of got my way.
Were you worried about, given that your father's, I'll sound like an alcoholic, that you kind of taking, you know, doing that yourself, drinking and all?
Oh yeah.
That you would become your father in some way, or that you were an alcoholic possibly, because they say it could be, you know, genetic or whatever.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. I was on the road to just repeating all that tragedy, but he was also a musician. He was a drummer, but he couldn't make a full-time career out of it, but he played nights and, you know, he lost his way. He had a lot of problems when he was a kid.
And, yeah.
You know, but I just saw it happening to me, but I didn't care, you know, because girls liked trouble guys, you know,
yeah.
Boys.
Yeah.
Girls like a mess. They want a project, you know, to fix.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was. you know, and so that kind of was the introduction into show business. But radio was, you know, I started to do stand-up comedy, but anything I wrote that I thought was funny would not be, it wouldn't ring true with an audience. So I would rather stand up there and throw shit against the wall for 20 minutes. You know, and if I triumphed, it was like by total serendipity.
Yeah.
And if you died hard. You went to hell in a twisted metal fireball. You know that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I got out and I started doing radio because of that little happenstance. And I was coming in. I was writing my own bits and I was producing my own bits and recording them. So that put me in a direction of kind of a real career. And then I sobered up and I stopped the drugs and the drinking and I moved to New York where I worked with Howard Stern for a few years.
That's great. When you do something for corporations, for, you know, and like the chocolate M&M voice or the Honey Nut Cheerio voice, Buzz, the Honey Nut Bee, do you have less, you have greater parameters because those are business people who don't really, it's not like you're working with a director or a creator like Matt Groening, who has a lot of times probably clear vision of what they want or what they're thinking about. Since you're working with more business people, do you have greater latitude to make that voice what you want to make it? I mean, I know the Milk Chocolate M&M was John Lovitz before you did it, but, or is it the opposite and they kind of, they're very corporate and they're very hands-on and they tell you what they want it to be?
Well, they liked what I did in the audition process, which was sort of like, it was kind of a wise guy. My own voice was kind of like a wise guy, like, you know, have you ever eaten me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yellow. you know, I've been doing that for 26 years.
Yeah, yeah. It came naturally to you, yeah.
Well, yeah, but they liked, there was something about it they just liked. It's just the regular sound of my voice messing around.
Yeah.
The wise guy kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't abrasive, you know. I mean, you have to somehow have likability.
Yeah.
Facts are going in your favor. And it's funny, the yellow M&M, you know, there was used to be this show on TV called Oz, and it was the prison show.
Yeah, Tom Fontana show, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, HBO, and the worst guy in the prison was this, you know, Schillinger, who was like a murderer and everything bad, he was on that list, you know, the worst guy in the jail.
Mm.
And one time I came home and my wife was watching Oz and she said, sit down, you got to see the show. Look at this guy right here. Look at this guy. You know, he ain't no actor. He's the real deal. And I'm looking at him and I started snortling like, you know, what? I said, I know him. You do? Yeah, he's the yellow M&M.
That guy is a yellow M&M?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, he stole the first Spider-Man movie as J. Jonah Jameson, and he won an Oscar for Whiplash. I knew this guy was a national treasure the day I met him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a real journeyman. You know, he does these State Farm insurance commercials. Then he's in movies. Then he's got a couple of TV shows going. And he does the yellow M&M, and a few days after he won the Oscar for Whiplash, he was in there working with me doing M&M.
Oh, that's incredible. Do you go around?
Yeah, no attitude, you know, just so refreshing.
Do you, when you're going through your day-to-day life, like as a comic, I think I'm sort of always consciously or subconsciously open to something that could be funny. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not walking around going, okay, listen to the conversation at Starbucks by these two people and see if you can get something. I'm just, I'll hear something and I'll go, oh, that's interesting. And I'll make a note. Are you doing that with voices? Are you just always consciously sort of in tune and your ear is, you know, pricked up for the, you know, hearing something unique that you would might use later in some way?
My world was a sonic one when I was growing up. I mean, I used to listen to everything and everybody. And it all went in. And I grabbed personas. Everybody I ever met had something about them. And I somehow I could restore it or keep it in my mind, like the kind of attitudes and, you know, the machinations of people. You got to know people really well, like all kinds of people. You know what I mean? And for you to be able to play it where people will go, wow, that works for me. That seems so realistic.
Yeah.
And that's what you want. But you don't want people to think that, oh, that's realistic. You just want to suspend their disbelief.
Right.
And let them just enjoy it for what it is without having to think about it.
Right. Right.
And I, you know, I was really lucky. I got to express myself in so many different ways. But yeah, I used to listen to everything and, you know, and I used to listen to myself. I mean, I've heard tapes of myself when I was smashed and it's like, oh good God, you know, you want to flush them down the toilet.
Yeah.
But I learned a few things.
Yeah.
Learned a few things about what goes on inside when somebody's, ossified.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You learn what not to do. Well,
but I tried to do comedy for a while, but I just wasn't hitting the mark. I mean, what I do, I used to make fun of comedy with my act. You know, I just come out and go, you ever notice everything? There'd be a plant on stage and I start shaking it and screaming Little Shop of Horrors. I'd be singing it.
Well, it sounds a little bit like Andy Kaufman, you know, it's sort of performance art, you know?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I was more inclined to do. I couldn't come up with 12 minutes and make it appear as if, you know, that I just thought of it, you know, every night of the week.
Yeah, I mean, I never met you, talked to you before, but just in the time that we've been doing this conversation, it's very clear that your mind can't just, your mind is very fertile and goes in a lot of directions. It's not surprising to me that you can't, in a weird way, to be a comic, a good stand-up, you almost have to be linear in a way in your thinking and very focused on nuance in one little word and this and that. And I could see that
my hat's off to you because it takes a lot of hard work and a lot of discipline. That's what you're going to do. And I know what it's like to work hard. I always had immigrant mentality, you know, if I could work 16 hours a day, I would do it always because I never said no to work. But I also had passion and determination, but they were in a different direction.
Yeah. And it's smart.
Focusing it on stage.
Yeah. And it's smart that you listen to that because, I mean, one last question. Ren and Stimpy, I think, in the annals of time, I just love that show. And how did that voice come about for you? Because it's a little bit of a, it's a pretty bizarre show in some ways. And so I'm really curious.
It's terribly bizarre. They weren't cartoons. They were cries for help. but other than that, I mean, Stimpy the Cat was based clearly on, well, maybe not so clearly to people who don't know, but I love the Three Stooges. I love them. When I discovered the Three Stooges, I stopped going to church. I mean, I found my saint.
Yeah, and you used to do Larry Fine on the Howard Stern Show, The Middleman, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That became Stimpson J. Cat. You know, you couldn't have a cartoon character that sounded like a depressed old Jewish guy, you know? Oy, mein hernia. You know, it had to be kind of up there. And,
yeah.
Will you button me, Ren? Oh! I kill you!
And so that was where that came from for you?
Yeah. You know, I auditioned for both roles, and what I did had sold the show to Nickelodeon, but then the guy that created the show, John Crisfalusi, decided he wanted to do Ren. And I didn't give a bad broad-ass because I had a job. I didn't care who did what, to tell you the truth. I was working, and this was early on in my career.
Mm.
And I was also doing Doug for Nickelodeon, which is this, you know, painful child, 11.5-year-old. And this is my dog, Porkchop. And there's the bad kid. Hey, loser, I'm running for Congress. So vote for this.
So you're spanning the gamut at the same. You're really running the gamut at the same time. You know, doing something like Stimpy and then Doug. It's really interesting.
Yeah,
it's quite the talent. It's great having you on. I got a better understanding of how you do what you do, which is why I love to do this show. So I really appreciate it. The animated series on Netflix, Disenchantment, created by Matt Groening, and this is the voice of Sosirio, the Jester. Pops the Elf, the red M&M, the plain M&M, when you see the M&Ms, if you eat Honey Nut Cheerios, he was that boy.
No,
see,
not that anymore. I stopped doing that a long time.
No, I know, but I'm still giving you, I'm still giving you credit for it. Don't worry about it. It's your Popeye.
Okay, I love the long drum roll.
Yeah. Marge Schott. That voice is like, I love that because it was so obscure. I think you were the only person that was doing Marge Schott. That was so awesome.
Yeah, but it didn't sound anything like her. It's just based on women I knew, older women, when I lived in Boston.
Yeah.
You know, and they were, it was quite a divide. You know, there were a lot of people like her that were screaming about ethnics. And,
right.
You know, but the thing is who even cares or knows what the real Marge Schott sounded like? It sounded like that in interviews, you know, when you read about her. So
yeah, you just needed to get the essence of her. For those listening who don't know, we're talking about the former owner of the Cincinnati Reds, who was pretty racist, this older woman, and she was kind of, you know, off her rocker. But I get what you're saying. As long as you get the essence of the person, it's good enough, you know what I mean? To get you there. Well, good luck with the show. Good luck with all your voiceover work. Come on anytime to talk about anything you want. Really great having you on.
I'd love to. I enjoyed talking to you. I'd love to do that.
Yeah, anytime. Open door. You got my cell. I got yours. And
cool.
It is Billy West, everybody. Thanks for listening. And thanks for being on, Billy.
And there's a final word. Goodbye.
All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed Billy West. Really cool dude. And don't forget, starting September 12th, my one-man show, Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio on Broadway, kicks back into gear. We're taking a little break to move venues. So if you're in town in New York City, starting September 12th, going forward, come see me. You can get tickets at telecharge.com. They'll be going on sale shortly. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com, for more information. If you have any questions, you can email me through my website, paulmercurio.com. And thanks again, as always, for being part of the podcast and supporting the podcast. And check out BetDSI. They're a great sponsor. And we'll see you next week, everybody. Thanks.